Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Grace Batchelain. On April 27th, 2020, the Supreme Court held by a vote of 8-1 that the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act's now expired risk corridor statute created a government obligation to pay insurers the full amount of their computed losses. The statute in question, known as risk corridors, set a formula for calculating payments to healthcare insurers for unexpectedly unprofitable plans during the first 3 years of online insurance marketplaces. The judgment reversed and remanded the case to the courts below. The opinion was written by Justice Sotomayor, and Justices Thomas and Gorsuch joined the opinion except for Parts 3C. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion. And now, to discuss the case, we have Julia Mahoney, Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law.
The Supreme Court's April 27, 2020 decision in Maine Community Health Options v. United States marked a resounding victory for four health insurance companies that sought compensation from the federal government for losses they incurred from participating in new insurance marketplaces established by the Affordable Care Act. The impact of the court's decision for both the insurance companies and the federal government is considerable. For hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions of dollars, were on the line. That said, the significance of Maine Community Health Options in the United States extends far beyond the resolution of yet another squabble arising out of the implementation of one of the most controversial laws ever passed by the United States Congress. That is because at the heart of Maine Community Options is by difficult and important questions about the nature of the vast financial commitments of the United States government. Most importantly, Maine Community Health Options illuminates our understanding of how and under what circumstances the United States government may bind and unbind itself to pay money. I'll begin this discussion with the background of the dispute between the federal government and the health insurance companies that led to the litigation, and then I'll discuss the majority opinion, written by Justice Sotomayor and joined in full, or nearly so, by the Chief Justice, as well as Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan, Kavanaugh, Thomas, and Gorsuch. I'll also say a few words about Justice Alito's dissent for himself alone, and then I'll turn to the case's broader ramifications. Commonly known as the Risk Corridors case, Maine Community Health Options v. United States involves a provision of the Affordable Care Act that sought to encourage insurers to offer policies on the new health insurance exchanges to be set up pursuant to the Act. Insurers were, understandably, wary, fearing large losses from novel insurance products. To allay the concerns of the insurance companies and to entice them to agree to participate in the newly organized healthcare insurance exchanges, the Affordable Care Act set up a scheme under which the federal government would bear some of the downside and, incidentally, share in some of the upside in the initial 3 years of the Affordable Care Act's implementation. Section 1342 of the Affordable Care Act provided that insurers, quote, shall pay the federal government money should they realize profits above a set threshold, and that the federal government, quote, shall pay insurers in certain circumstances to compensate them for losses incurred by their willingness to participate in these new insurance exchanges. Congress did not, it bears emphasis, appropriate any funds at the time of the passage of the Affordable Care Act to cover the then potential costs to the federal government of this risk corridors program. Now, these risk corridors, as with many other provisions of the Affordable Care Act, were highly controversial. Critics pointed out that under the terms of Section 1342, there was no cap on the federal government's potential liability to insurance companies for participating in the program, and that the risk corridor program could end up increasing the nation's budget deficit. As it turned out, the concerns of the critics were not entirely misplaced, for the federal government did indeed end up owing insurance companies far more than insurance companies owed the federal government. In the first year of the Risk Corridor Program, the federal government owed $2.87 billion to insurance companies, and insurance companies in turn owed a mere $362 million to the federal government. The response of Congress was to take action to attempt to stem what many in Congress anyway saw as a hemorrhage of federal funds. Congress attached riders to appropriations bills, and these riders restricted or purported to restrict the amounts of money available from the federal treasury to make insurers whole for their risk corridor program losses. Not surprisingly, insurers that had suffered losses objected fiercely. In their view, Section 1342 of the Affordable Care Act amounted to a legally enforceable obligation on the part of the federal government. Having enticed them to enter these new unproven markets, the insurers argued, the federal government could not now renege on its promise to limit the losses suffered by the insurance companies. Four aggrieved insurers, including Maine Community Health Options, invoked the Tucker Act and filed suit in the United States Court of Federal Claims. There were varying outcomes at the trial level in these cases, with defeats for most of the insurance companies, but an award of partial summary judgment for one. On appeal, a divided panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit ruled in the government's favor. While the panel majority agreed with the insurance companies that the effect of Section 1342 of the Affordable Care Act upon its enactment had been to create a United States government obligation to make insurers whole for losses, it found that the congressional appropriations riders had repealed or suspended these payment obligations. The insurance companies appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed. Congress did indeed create an obligation for the U.S. government to pay insurers the amount set out in Section 1342, states Justice Sotomayor's opinion for the court. What is more, while it is true that the typical route to creating and satisfying a government obligation is to proceed in four steps, with the passage of an organic act like the Affordable Care Act that creates a program, agency, or function, followed by the passage of an act authorizing appropriations, and then an enactment of the actual appropriation, and finally, the incurrence of the relevant obligation by the government, Congress can, in the words of Justice Sotomayor, quote, deviate from this pattern. And, deviating from this pattern, create an obligation, quote, directly by statute, without also providing details about how it must be satisfied. Neither the Appropriations Clause of the U.S. Constitution nor the Anti-Deficiency Act serves to qualify an obligation created or incurred directly by statute. And as to the question of whether having created these obligations, Congress in effect repealed or suspended them through the appropriations riders, the court's answer is a simple no. Congress could have, the court stresses, but did not expressly repeal Section 1342. And while the court does not close the door completely on implied repeals, Justice Sotomayor's opinion stresses that under relevant Supreme Court precedent, repeals by implication are not favored and indeed are a rarity. Congressional intention to repeal, the majority stresses, must be clear and manifest. Now, precisely what congressional action will satisfy this clear and manifest standard is not, on the terms of the majority opinion, entirely clear. But what is clear is that mere omission by Congress to appropriate sufficient funds is not going to amount to an appeal. Finally, the majority holds that the health insurers properly relied on the Tucker Act to sue for damages in the Court of Federal Claims. Noting that the United States is immune from suit unless it unequivocally consents, and that the federal government has, through the Tucker Act, waived immunity for certain damages suits in the Court of Claims, the majority opinion states that Section 1342 of the Affordable Care Act met the requirement of establishing a substantive right mandating compensation by the federal government. In so finding, Justice Sotomayor emphasizes that the risk corridor statute is one of the rare laws permitting a damages suit in the Court of Federal Claims, and takes pains to explain the importance of the specific shall pay language of Section 1342 to the court's decision. Justice Sotomayor wraps up her opinion by invoking a principle that she terms as old as the nation itself, namely that the government will honor its obligations. The majority opinion quotes Alexander Hamilton's 1790 report on public credit in support of this assertion that the United States has always made good on its promises. Justice Alito's solo dissent argues that the outcome in Maine Community Health Options marks a departure from the court's general practice of the past two decades of declining to recognize private rights of action not expressly authorized by Congress. Justice Alito also characterizes the outcome in Maine Community Health Options as a, quote, massive bailout for insurance companies that took a calculated risk and lost. Justice Alito's recommendation, not followed, obviously, by the court, is to request supplemental briefing on the issue of when causes of action to recover damages under the Tucker Act should be inferred and to set the cases for re-argument. Now, turning to the bigger picture, what light does Maine Community Health Options shed on United States government finances in general, and in particular, on how the federal government can commit to paying money at a later date? There are two things, I believe, that stand out in Maine Community Health Options as deserving of our attention. First, this case underscores what I see as a very important and understudied recent development in United States government finance, the decreasing relevance of the standard appropriations process. It is conventional wisdom that Congress must appropriate funds for all public expenditures, and that, albeit with a few exceptions, government agencies may not raise or spend funds unless Congress has so appropriated them. But as a number of scholars in recent years have pointed out, including Krista Muth and Michael Grevy, it now turns out that what actually occurs is in tension with this conventional wisdom. As Krista Muth and Michael Grevy put it, to an unprecedented extent, many regulatory agencies are now relying on non-appropriated funds for their ordinary operations. What is occurring in Maine Community Health Options, I believe, is another manifestation of this decreasing relevance of the standard congressional appropriations process. Even though the court in Maine Community Health Options emphasizes that what occurred is not standard practice, the court does emphasize that Congress has broad latitude to deviate from the norm. If there are any significant restrictions on the circumstances under which Congress can deviate, the majority opinion does not give us any clue in Maine Community Health Options. The second thing that I think is worth our attention is the explicit assumption of the majority opinion that the United States government has always made good on its financial commitments, coupled with an implicit assumption that the United States government will always be able to do so. The claim that the U.S. government has always made good on its financial commitments, always paid its obligations in full and on time, is simply not accurate as a historical matter. Alexander Hamilton, even though he emphasized the importance of sound public credit, actually presided over a significant debt restructuring. That is, not all the creditors who extended money to the United States for it to win its independence ended up being paid back in full and on time. And as for the implicit assumption that the United States will always be able to pay whatever obligations it incurs, at a time when the federal deficit is exploding and the national debt is increasing in ways that are unprecedented, it makes sense, I believe, for us to at least acknowledge that that may not be the case, and that even if Congress has taken on obligations, it may well be that the United States has too many obligations to be able to pay them all, and that serious consideration may need to be given to how the United States is going to prioritize its obligations.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.